Tonight on Arena, John Cooper Clarke celebrating 50 years in showbiz and Gary Lightbody of Snow Patrol on the band's new album. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. The Bard of Salford will be at the Helix in Dublin tomorrow, celebrating 50 years in showbiz. I'm delighted that he is here with me in studio this evening, Dr. John Cooper Clarke, who was regaling me with some great poems, I have to say, during the nuacht, none of which we could repeat. But John,
the station down. It's a family audience.
What did strike me as you and he's, and I was looking through some of the poems today and listened to you, your starting point even beyond 50 years, you're 50 years in showbiz, but you're writing poetry since long before that. You're starting to, and your love of poetry starts in quite a traditional place in many ways.
School.
Yeah, and Palgrave's Golden Treasury.
Compulsory. We were called upon to learn it all off by heart as well, you know, the way that Mr. Michael Gove recommended all those years ago. That it led to all kinds of... That was actually considered to be controversial, but that was the norm when I was at school. Mm. You had to commit them to memory and be able... If you were called upon to recite, say, you know, the third verse of The Charge of the Light Brigade, you had to...
Be there and ready.
Be there and do it. So, but like they say, it never did me any harm. Quite the reverse. It put me on the road to, you know, the life I enjoy today.
And I guess that learning by heart and reciting by heart is kind of feeds directly into the way you are a performance poet.
Well, it absolutely does. Plus, it's the best way to appreciate poetry is to hear it in every case. In every case, if you're reading it out of a book silently, it's you're missing half the, you know, you're missing. It's like a blind man going to the movies. You're only getting half the experience there. Mm. I think it's, you know, it should be euphonious. And there's only one way to find out whether that's taking place, and that's, for me anyway, I never know whether a poem's any good until an audience tells me it is.
I can see
but that's that. But that's because, you know, people write poetry for all sorts of reasons, you know, catharsis or dealing with problems that they, personal problems and all kinds of reasons like that. But I never ever wrote poetry for that reason. It was the only thing I was ever any good at. Mm. At school.
And is that why you wrote poetry? Because you were good at it?
Yeah, I wrote it because I was good at it. And the more I wrote, the better I got. And then I figured, you know, I'm going to be a professional at this, you know. And I was dissuaded from this course of action by anybody who cared about me, you know, on the grounds that poetry has never been a recognised engine of wealth. So, and everybody I mentioned, it was all, yeah, well, he's got another job, you know, Philip Larkin, he's a librarian, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I couldn't point at any examples of this, but I was wrong, because if you look at the sort of late period of the English music halls, there was always a monologue artist on that bill. Mm. So it was a very popular means of entertainment at the turn of the 19th century. And so I thought, well, you know, why not? And, you know, it's no accident that, you know, advertisements use rhyme, you know. People genuinely have an inbuilt. And unlike every other art form, poetry is, you know, I think everybody gives it a go.
Absolutely. You know, and you talk about the music hall feel there and rhymes. Let's hear I Wrote the Songs. People will recognise this. Many of the titles here, kind of.
Well, this is this concerns all those times. It's an occupational hazard for anybody who writes lyrics or poetry for a living, that somebody comes along and changes one word of your title and has a worldwide mega smash with it. And the very title of this piece, I Wrote the Songs, was purloined by Barry Manilow in 1972 and was a big hit for David Cassidy also in the same year. However, this was my version. I wrote the songs, and this features all those, some of those times where that happened to me. I wrote the songs that nearly made the bottom line of the hit parade. Almost anthems should have been hits. Songs like Putting Off the Ritz, Some Enchanted Afternoon, 24 Hours from Levenzoom, Dancing in the Daylight, Singing in the Smog, You Ain't Nothing But a Hedgehog. So close and yet so far, do you remember the way we are? I'd like to get you on a speedboat to China, from an idea by George Steiner. Ain't no slouch, Mama's got a brand new couch. She ain't heavy, she's my sister, not to mention Twist and Whisper, brand new leopard skin, pillbox, glove. Baby, you and me got a greasy kind of love. I wrote the song. But correct me if I'm incorrect, but most people seem to latch on to You Ain't Nothing But a Hedgehog there. So just to show you that there are tunes to go with these titles, here's a little clip from You Ain't Nothing But a Hedgehog. You ain't nothing but a hedgehog, foraging all the time. You ain't nothing but a hedgehog, foraging all the time. You ain't never pricked a predator. You ain't no porcupine.
I wrote the songs by John Cooper Clarke. And it is so performative, that, John, and it plays so much into the whole rhyming scheme and playing with the rhymes.
Technical problems of poetry manufacture.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah. Entertainment clearly was very much at the heart, well, in poems like that, of what you wanted to do.
Well, absolutely. Why not? You know, I mean, I think that's what poetry was, you know, like my... Like all art form, what do they say? Ernest Hemingway said that all sport aspires to boxing. Well, I would paraphrase that and say that all art aspires to poetry. If you see a work of art, a sculpture, a painting, or hear a symphony or any piece of music, and it has a lasting quality that, you know, a quality that haunts you for the rest of your life after that, you know, then what's the adjective that you would use for that piece of art? You would say it has a poetic quality. Mm. And in that way, you know, I think that poetry is, well, the defining nature of all art is uselessness.
Useless, but...
So it's part of the entertainment world, really.
But when we hear a poem like that and I hear you speaking like that, it seems difficult in some ways to marry you with the period when you came into your own as a poet, the time of the Sex Pistols, Joy Division, The Fall, the late 1970s, and that kind of knocking down the establishment that was involved in that period in time. Where do you see your poetry fitting into that social movement, if you like?
Well, my lyrics were all quite area-specific at the time when I was discovered by the punk rock crowd. But I was already working in cabaret joints, so I sort of looked the part. I had I used to wear kind of, you know, a tonic suit, and I had very short sort of suede head haircut. And so I kind of, and if you remember in 1975, when I was working in these clubs, middle-aged men were wearing kick-flared trousers with, seed packet floral shirts and hair over their ears and sideburns that rambled all over their face, you know. So to be dressed in this sort of Ivy League suit with short hair and, you know, Chelsea boots was seen as a quite kind of anachronistic, let's say. But it really kind of slotted into the punk rock look, which, of course, there were only really two rules, sartorial rules in punk rock: no beards, no flares. But it was amazing how difficult it was to get trousers that weren't flared in the 70s.
At that time?
That was a full-time job.
And you still managed to write a few poems in the time as well. Yeah. But I'm interested in, you know, is there a kind of a social aspect to what you're writing as well? I was reading through the poem Beasley Street.
Very broad.
Yeah, but talk to me about the kind of ideas that you are going through when you... It's a fictionalised... I was checking this with you before we came to air.
Well, it's a fictionalised place. You know, it's obviously inspired by my hometown. That's where I wrote it at the time. Oh, no, it wasn't. I'll tell you when I wrote it. I wrote it when I was on tour with Richard Hell and the Voidoids and Elvis Costello and the Attraction in 1979. And that's when I wrote it. I figured, I don't want to be the light relief. So I thought I'd better write something that sort of sounds like it's serious. But there wasn't any political agenda with it. I'd hate to think that my work was viewed through any kind of political lens. I would hate that. I don't think it's helpful, really, for any artist to have their world view known. I think it impedes the enjoyment of what it is. I think it's not helpful.
In fact, even though this then looks at a city in decay, I want the listeners to really listen to the final line of this poem. You're going to give me a couple of stanzas just from the tail end of the poem.
Yes, of course.
And you're going to start with the section that starts on "The boys are on the wagon."
Yes, of course, Sean. The boys are on the wagon, the girls are on the shelf. Their common problem is that they're not someone else. The dirt blows out, the dust blows in, you can't keep it neat. It's a fully furnished dustbin, 16 Beasley Street. People turn to poison quick as lager turns to piss. Sweethearts are physically sick every time they kiss. It's a sociologist's paradise, each day repeats. Uneasy, cheesy, greasy, queasy, beastly Beasley Street.
The tail end of Beasley Street. Now, obviously, we are talking about a city in decay there and, you know, people who are in difficult situations. But
it's not gritty realism.
No, it's not.
It's got a bit of magic about it.
Well, part of the magic is that final line. What's the origins of that final line?
I wrote the final line first. That was it. I wrote that poem backwards on account of... I stole that big finish from a movie...
42nd Street.
42nd Street, thank you. Yes, directed by Busby Berkeley in 1936, starring Dick Powell and Ruby Keeler. And 42nd Street, the big production number featuring vignettes and dance routines. And, you know, it's the main part of the film, really, and it ends on the line. The song 42nd Street ends on the line, "Naughty, gaudy, sportish, naughty, 42nd Street." You know, and so with that in mind, I thought it's a great way to finish a song. You know, it's the big finish, that. After that, there is no more. So I thought, well, you know, what if it was a lousy neighbourhood? What if it was a lousy sort of neighbourhood that I would know? So I thought, well, what rhymes with greasy and seedy and cheesy and, you know what I mean? First of all, I stole the name of a jockey, a well-known jockey at the time, Scobie Breasley. And then I thought, well, I can't use that. I was paranoid about future litigation issues with this jockey who could afford a better lawyer than I. So I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in utter penury. So I thought, knock off the R, Beasley, leave it with Beasley. Beasley,
so
uneasy, cheesy, greasy.
Beasley Street.
So that's how that happens. And then I worked my way back from that.
From there.
It's part, those two stanzas are part of a much longer poem. Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's done some great business for me, that poem.
Yeah, and you talk about, you know, the several people that you toured there, Elvis Costello amongst them. We talked about the punk rock era earlier on, and you were often part of those musical gigs as well. But Arctic Monkeys took you on board. Let's hear the poem that got them excited.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I couldn't be happier about this. You know, they did such a great job of converting this poem into that song on the AM album. Mm. And they've done a great job, and I wish I'd done it like that in the first place. But I'm not possessed of Alex Turner's mellifluous mezzo baritone. A gift to the music industry. Great band. I love them. I met them a week before they went global at a club in Sheffield called The Boardwalk. And they just left school, I think, at the time. You know, they were all pals with each other. And they had this real gang sort of thing about them that you just knew they were going to go places. And, you know, every record they've brought out has been different from its predecessor. Terrific. Real lot of talent in that band. A lot of talent in that band. And it's very rare to see a poem converted into a song, actually. I was saying earlier on, the only other example of a poem being converted into a song was "The Road to Mandalay," as sung by Frank Sinatra.
There you go.
But what do you know, that one? It starts off with the line, "Take me somewhere east of Suez, where the best is like the worst, and there ain't no Ten Commandments, and a cat can raise a thirst. Adapted from the Rudyard Kipling poem, The Roads of Manderley. I don't think Rudyard Kipling wrote "A cat can raise a thirst," however. I think Frank threw that in after the event.
Yeah. Let's hear "I Want to Be Yours."
"I Want to Be Yours," yeah. My version goes like this. It's also the title of my memoir, still on sale in the shops. "I Want to Be Yours," my version goes like this. And by the way, before the Arctic Monkeys covered this number, it was already the wedding favourite of the 21st century in the UK. Anyway, so here it is. My version goes like this. "I Want to Be Yours" by Dr. John Cooper Clarke. "Let me be your vacuum cleaner, breathing in your dust. Let me be your Morris Marina, I will never rust. If you like your coffee hot, let me be your coffee pot. You call the shots, I want to be yours. Let me be your raincoat for those frequent rainy days. Let me be that dream boat when you want to sail away. Let me be your teddy bear. Take me with you anywhere. I don't care. I want to be yours. Let me be your electric meter. I will never run out. Let me be the electric heater you get pneumonia without. Let me be that setting lotion that grips your skull with deep devotion. Deep as the deep Atlantic Ocean. That's how deep is my devotion. A deep, 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 deep. I don't want to be hers. I want to be yours."
Dr. John Cooper Clarke with "I Want to Be Yours." And you can kind of see, you even sing little bits of that as you go along. So
I like to think I can carry a tune, Sean.
You said to me that you wanted to read one poem that you think is quite interesting to read in Ireland because it has a very English feel to it. It's called "Pies."
Well, that's right. My question to you was this, Sean. Is there a thing for area-specific pies in the Republic of Ireland?
Not particularly that I know. I don't think there's a pie that has a town name or a place name.
No. Do they sell them at the chipper?
You might get a steak kidney pie
there.
Steak
and kidney?
Yeah, maybe.
Not meat and potato, you know?
Nah.
See, they don't do meat and potato pies south of Birmingham in England. But it was always my favourite pie. It's the go-to football terrace pie. Sticks to your ribs on a cold November Saturday afternoon on the terraces.
It's the go-to pie.
There are many other kinds of pies. And so we've ascertained that there is no pie culture as such
in Ireland, yes.
In Ireland. Well, this will be a slice of exoticism for you then here. Pies. "A homely girl named Lisa couldn't get a geezer. Her mother told her, 'Darling, don't you cry. You could knock 'em down like Skittles with some farinaceous victuals and you'll always get a guy with a pie.' When rules of engagement don't apply and your best moves fail to catch his eye, start rolling out that dough and he'll never let you go. You'll always get a guy with a pie. The salad's in the bin. I've never seen a gym, but I'll be there to watch those people die. I feel fine except I'm hungry all the time and you'll always get a guy with a pie. Please God, I will be going by and by to that massive cafeteria in the sky. There'll be tea and angel cake, but hey, give me a break. You'll always get a guy on high with a pie. You'll always get a guy with a pie. Even when they're stale, they taste okay with ale at the point where hunger pangs intensify. Cold weather grub that may be eaten in a public house. You'll always get a pie-eyed guy with a pie. You'll always get a guy with a pie. What else you gonna do with that leftover stew and those cuts of meat you can't identify? Ingredients of this sort just taste better under short crust. You'll always get a guy with a I spy with my little eye something beginning with OI. You'll always get a guy with a pie."
Pies,
that one's called, Sean.
Performed for us by Dr. John Cooper Clarke, who will be live in the Helix tomorrow, Friday the 13th. Special guest Mike Garry will be there as well. More
Mike Garry from the planet Manchester. Don't miss this man. Manchester Ireland's fine, part of the diaspora.
Absolutely. Helix.ie.
Ever-growing diaspora of fine poets from...
Well, there you go. Helix.ie is the website there, and John's most recent book, What, is published by Picador. Snow Patrol have been a staple of the music world for over two decades now, delivering unforgettable songs like Chasing Cars and Run. Since their breakthrough album, The Final Straw, in 2003, they've performed in front of 100,000 strong crowds, have written songs with everyone from Ed Sheeran to Taylor Swift. And the band's journey from indie roots in Northern Ireland to international stardom, nothing short of remarkable. But it has at times been a tricky road for the band as well. They are releasing a new album, The Forest is the Path. It comes out tomorrow. I'm delighted to be joined on Arena this evening by frontman of Snow Patrol, Gary Lightbody. Gary, lovely to be speaking with you and thanks for being on the programme with us. The Forest is the Path. Yourself, Nathan Connolly and Johnny McDade took yourself off to a house in Somerset and all sat down together and I think just got stuck at it. Was it an unusual and a different way of going about writing an album from previously?
Hey, well, hello, Sean. How are you doing? You all right?
Good. All great here and with you too, I hope.
And good with me too. And I tell you what, a difficult, very, very difficult man to follow, John Cooper Clark. I'll do my very best.
You'll have to speak in rhyme, Gary.
I'll leave that to the genius that is Mr. Cooper Clark. But I guess we got together in a wee house in Somerset and just basically started writing. But we normally things would happen a little bit more disparately. There'd be ideas floating around, there'd be melodies floating around, there'd be lyrics written by me at various times. But this time we wrote each song in a day. So start to finish, from blank page to finished song, it was, you know, a matter of sometimes a couple of hours, sometimes 10 hours, but it was all done in the each song was done in the same day. So that was slightly different for us. You know, and I think a better way of doing things that only took us 30 years to figure that out.
Well, I'm wondering what made it better. Was there a lack of rumination and a kind of an agreement? When we say that's it, put the full stop in as much as you can. We'll put it to the one side and we'll record it later on.
Well, I'm terrible at putting the full stop on it, to be honest. I've never done tinkering and, you know, continuing. But yeah, I think in terms of the songwriting, that was for sure. In terms of the recording process, obviously that takes a lot more time. But yeah, it was good to sort of feel... I mean, there's no real pressure because, of course, you don't have to do it in a day, but it was good to feel that little bit of pressure or, like, for myself to get the lyrics finished in sort of a good pace, a good clip, because previous albums, there was a song on the last album which lived up to its name called Life on Earth. It took me 5 years to write the lyrics.
Wow.
So this time around, you know, everything was kind of done in a day, but I had done an awful lot of prep as well for the record, you know, I'd written an awful lot, and I was able to then sort of take a line or two and plonk it into a song so that blank page wasn't blank anymore.
Yeah.
And it makes it a little bit less of a high wire act.
Yeah, so there was a little bit of, there were a few lyrics knocking about and they might have started the ball rolling. Let's have a listen to the track that opens the album. This is All. There you go. That is the opening track on the new Snow Patrol album. Gary Lightbody of Snow Patrol with me on the programme this evening. I was interested, Gary, in how that lyric starts out there with this kind of idea of this is not... Well, you start by saying it's not a love song, for starters, but I just want to feel like I belong, but I don't know where I am. Coming out of Wildness, which was the previous album, where you have spoken quite openly and about how you struggled with a period of alcoholism and with addiction to various substances and depending on them maybe for some kind of solace. You spoke a lot about that in Wildness, and it was very personal and very, very raw. There seems to be a slight move on from that in this album, but it's still a kind of a questioning tone in there.
Yes, I've been sober now 8 years, so I think a certain amount of clarity has come with that. So I'm able to think back to, you know, over the last, you know, I don't know, 20 years of my life or however long, and with maybe some more clarity than I had before. And I'm able to, I think I'm seeing things slightly differently, and I'm feeling a lot different in my life, a lot calmer, which is a good thing.
Yeah, because that's the title of the album itself, The Forest is the Path, has quite a philosophical feel to it.
Yes, it actually that song, the song All that you just played, kind of references it, but I don't know where I am. The Forest is the Path to me is that feeling of being lost, but it's okay. And I think so many times in my life where I felt like I'm lost in a forest in my mind or whatever, and I've been afraid. And now I understand that sometimes it's okay to be lost, and that's maybe where you're meant to be, and feel a lot more grounded in it. And I think that just makes the ship feel a lot steadier.
Right. When I was listening to All there, and with you on the other side of the line, funnily, I can now hear that big chorus as a stadium anthem. I mean, it just you can already hear people singing along, and that is a classic event at most of your performances. The audience, particularly on this island, you can stop playing if you want, and they will continue singing for you.
Yeah, we're very lucky. We played Thomond Park in Limerick earlier this summer. And yeah, there were quite a few moments in that show where I stepped away from the microphone and everybody in the audience took over. And it never, ever gets old. That will always be thrilling.
And I would hazard a guess that this song is one of the ones where you can step back from the microphone.
Not yet, but maybe one day, but we don't take these things for granted, that's for sure.
Of course, Ron, I was tempted, Gary Lightbody, to actually fade it there during the chorus and see if we would hear audiences around this island singing that chorus. I'm sure you have had it shouted back and sung back to you at so many gigs and venues over the years.
One of the most extraordinary times that song was sung back to us was at Electric Picnic a couple of years ago. And at the end, normally they just sing the crowd sing the first part of the chorus back.
Yeah, light
that's
up,
the
light
end
up.
Of the song. Yeah. That's the end of the song. But they sung the next bit too, full voice, louder, louder. From that point as well, they just kept going, and it's never happened before. And it was one of those moments. We'll never forget.
I can imagine, and I suppose it is a specifically Irish thing, the singing along in that fashion. But Run was such a huge breakthrough moment, really, for the band, wasn't it, Gary?
Yes, I was just sort of talking about this earlier, in that I think a lot of people might think that Chasing, like looking back over our 30-year career, we would think that Chasing Cars was the most significant song, but Run is easily the most significant song. We were together 10 years. We'd never had a hit. We'd never had any success. And Run was the first song that made it possible for us to tour the world and have the career, have the lives that we have. And we're never taken for granted, and we're always so grateful. And Run started that journey, the second act of Snow Patrol.
Yeah, and interesting that you said to me earlier, talking about the new album, The Forest is the Path, that, you know, you feel you have a sense of kind of being not as hard on yourself about stepping back and about allowing things just to happen. I think that you have spoken before about that album, The Final Straw, was one where you kind of said, do you know what? I'm not going to listen to other people around me. We're not going to listen to, we should do this or we should do that. We're just going to do what feels right.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm really wonderfully encouraged by a great Irishman, Jackknife Lee, Garrett Lee, who, that was the first album that we worked with him on. And he was really encouraging. I think I was nervous about, I think I just discovered how to write a chorus. And I was like, am I allowed to write a chorus? And Garrett was like, this is what you want. This is what you want to say. This is what you want. So let's do this. And he really sort of fanned those flames, and it was him that sort of brought Run to where it ended up, which has ended up being, you know, sort of one of the songs that we're kind of known for, which I'm so happy about.
I'm wondering about growing up in Northern Ireland at the time you grew up, but what kind of musical infrastructure was in underneath you guys? Because, you know, Snow Patrol, for the first couple of albums, you were an indie outfit and certainly not known on a worldwide basis.
No.
But what musical ecosystem did you rise up out of?
Well, we were studying in Dundee University and then coming back to Northern Ireland to meet to Bangor and to Belfast, in the holidays. So we were playing gigs in both Scotland and Northern Ireland. Then we come down to Dublin and play gigs with a wonderful band called Turn. They would come up to Belfast and support us, and we would go down to Dublin and support them, and sort of making those connections and playing those early gigs. That was kind of our learning curve, and you know, it's in terms of there being infrastructure for music in Northern Ireland at the time, there wasn't really. There was a few small indie labels in Northern Ireland, and the music scene here has grown exponentially over the last 20 years into a really exciting verdant and thrilling scene.
And I know you're quite vocal and quite strong on how that scene, not just in terms of music, but right across the arts, that scene needs to be those sprigs or those seeds that will grow into the next, whatever you want to say, the next set of actors that come out of Northern Ireland, the next Snow Patrol that comes out of Northern Ireland. It needs to be funded properly. Funding the arts is essential to keep that ecosystem alive.
It certainly is. We, you know, in Northern Ireland, the arts budget has been cut 10% every year for the last 10 years. It went from 20 million in, you know, 10 years ago to just under 10 million this year. And, you know, if it keeps going that way, you know, so many things will just collapse. And obviously there are important essential things for like health and education and infrastructure, but the arts, the music, literature, movies, drama, opera, these are things that make life worth living, I think, for everybody. Certainly makes life worth living for me. And you know, we really need to make sure that there is a next generation of artists in Northern Ireland.
Well, from speaking to you, Garrett, it seems that for all the worldwide fame and the great success, the boy from Bangor is still alive and well and talking, yes. Which is something you saw, I think, in the case of both Ed Sheeran and Taylor Swift, who you met as quite young stars, even though they were big, but that even now, 10, 15, 20 years later, they're bigger, but still the same people.
Yes, absolutely. I saw Ed recently, and still the same person I met when he was 20. You know, which is extraordinary when people that famous can be, you know, can keep their feet on the ground. You know, it's really quite remarkable.
We might finish up, Gary, with "This Is the Sound of Your Voice" from the new album, "From the Forest Is the Path." Will you lead us into this and maybe give us a sense of, because Belfast features in this, and there's a touch of a love letter I hear to Belfast in it, or were there other things at play here as well?
Yeah, this is how I'm describing this one is rather than a day in a life, it's a life in a day. It's little vignettes of lives of, I sort of dedicate this song to my friends and family. It's things that I have picked up in the lives of the people that I care about deeply over the years. And I've put them all in a song, and I've sort of made it look like it's just two people, but it's really so many people in my life. And obviously Belfast and Northern Ireland and the island of Ireland as a whole is an extraordinary inspiration to me and has been always. So I always find a way to put to fit something of that in an album.
Well, that makes total sense in terms of the little stories that are told here, because I think there's a lot happening to a lot of people here, but that makes a lot of sense, the way you've explained it there. You must be looking forward to the Ulster Hall tomorrow night. I know it's already sold out. And your European tour, you'll be coming down to Dublin in February of next year, I guess that is. So I hope to see you at some point along one of those gigs, Gary. But thanks so much for joining us on the programme this evening.
Pleasure, Sean. Thank you so much. Take care.
You too. That's Gary Lightbody. And let us finish up with a little bit of This Is the Sound of Your Voice.
I've waited for your love so long, dear. I've waited for your love so long.
By the way, I stand corrected. Cork is mad for potato pies, says Vincent in Cork. He love you, John. That's John Cooper Clark he's talking about. Saw him on the last visit. And also great to hear the genius who is John Cooper Clark. Alan, a lifelong fan, says. And as I said, John Cooper Clark in the Helix tomorrow night. Gary Lightbody in the Ulster Hall in Belfast and Snow Patrol tomorrow night. But that's sold out. You will get them in the Three Arena on the 25th of February. Two nights at the SSE Arena in Belfast, February 27th, 28th of next year. Snowpatrol.com. We'll be reviewing the new album tomorrow night. So to whistle stop through our film reviews this evening, much anticipated, much delayed biographical film Lee with Kate Winslet as the photographer, renowned photographer and fashion model Lee Miller. Ian McKellen is back on the big screen with The Critic, the gay man in 1930s London. And in Speak No Evil, James McAvoy leans into his crazed villain mode, remake of a successful Danish chiller from 2002. Dee Malumbi and Dave Hanratty have been watching the movies for us, and they're with me here in the studio this evening. Let's start with Kate Winslet and the story that she's telling here. She really wants to tell this story, Dave. She really wanted to tell it.
Kate Winslet, yeah. I mean, she's producer on this project. She's the star. She essentially picked the director, Ellen Kuras, who she worked with before on Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, where Kuras was a cinematographer. This is her feature film debut as a director. The story goes is that one bought a book for the other, and then Kate Winslet was kind of like, I have to put this on the screen. This has to happen. Took a long time in gestation, but by the time she got to the big screen, it kind of came as a result of like a lot of male executives saying what Kate Winslet said were very, very patronising to her. And so she was like, I'll do it myself. I made personal phone calls, wrote handwritten letters to people. The cast is reflected by this. It's very clear that she called in some favours, but the real life person of Lee Miller spoke deeply to Kate Winslet, and that's why we have this movie.
Yeah, and the cast that she has gathered around her, particularly in the female members of the cast, hugely strong. The guys are good as well, but that's where the real that's what I think we should focus on.
Absolutely. Like, it's a very kind of female driven story about Lee Miller. You know, the fact that she really wanted to kind of publicise particularly the role of women during World War II and everything. And I think the fact that it is so female and feminist is reflective in that terrific cast as well. You've Marion Cotillard in there, Andrea Riseborough. Winslet and her would have actually also worked together in The Regime, which was a TV series out earlier this year, which Kate Winslet was also absolutely phenomenal in. Noémie Merlant is also in this movie. People might recognise her from, she was in that great movie, Portrait of a Lady on Fire. So yeah, absolutely stellar cast here as well. And the actors are fantastic as well. You've got Alexander Skarsgård in, albeit maybe a little cliched type of role as Lee's lover Roland, Josh O'Connor in what initially appears to be...
Yeah, and don't tell us where it goes.
Yes. No spoilers here. Yeah, and also Andy Samberg, who people might know from The Lonely Island and Brooklyn Nine-Nine, in a very rare dramatic appearance, which works quite well, actually.
And Josh O'Connor is this interviewing her, which is a sort of a framing device within the film itself. So let's listen to kind of spikiness that is there as Josh O'Connor asks a few questions and Kate Winslet as Lee Miller kind of answers them.
You're making a big deal out of nothing. They're just pictures.
I don't believe that. There must be stories behind them.
Why does it matter?
They should be heard. Don't you want the world to know about you? Or isn't that why you went there?
You think I went to war so people would know my name?
I didn't say that.
I think you did.
I'm not trying to interrogate you.
All interviews are interrogations. The good ones, anyway.
Kate Winslet and Josh O'Connor there in a scene from Lee. Does it work? I mean, it seems as if it has a lot of really good ingredients.
It should work. I don't think it works fully. There's something kind of small screen about it. There's something kind of artificial about it. And to use the photography analogy, it feels a bit overexposed and underdeveloped. I really wanted to tune into this, but it just never felt real. You're dealing with wartime atrocities. You're dealing with very serious real life history. And I couldn't help but just see actors playing dress up. And even how some of the dramatic beats land, like we said, we're dancing around Josh O'Connor in this in terms of where things go with him. Even that, the way that kind of plays out, it felt like it just wasn't carried off correctly. So, and look, Kate Winslet is very, as we said, is very clearly passionate about this, but I couldn't help but think this feels not quite a vanity project, but definitely an excuse to showcase her talents.
Stars?
2 out of 5. It just didn't work for me.
Yeah, okay. Well, a bit cynical. Maybe she deserves an Oscar. Maybe she's looking for it. Maybe she deserves it. Go ahead.
It's a perfectly serviceable movie. It is a shame that it kind of leans into a few biopic cliches. Like, my favourite scenes were definitely the ones that kind of recreated Lee's most famous photos. The actors are all terrific in it. Kate Winslet is perfection as always. She is one of the best working actors today. It's a 2.5 star movie for me.
2.5 star for you. Okay, let us move on then to film number 2, Speak No Evil, what's been called a social horror from director James Watkins and based on a Danish feature film of the same name from 2022. Two couples involved here, Dee.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a very kind of, it's funny because it's a horror movie, but really the horrors don't come so much from jump scares as the social kind of scenarios that these couples end up in. So we follow Louise and Ben, who are played by Mackenzie Davis and Scoot McNairy, and their daughter, Agnes. They make friends with another family, Paddy and Kira, who are played by James McAvoy and our own Irish actress, Aisling Franciosi, and their son, Ant. They spend this holiday together in Italy. It's full of fun, even though the couples are very much kind of opposites of one another. One is very uptight and one is very carefree. They all get along great. So Paddy and Kira invite Louise, Ben and Agnes to stay with them in their beautiful countryside house. But here the family starts to witness these strange events that make them kind of just want to go home.
Well, let's listen to a clip where the kids are just doing a little dance. And as we hear, James McAvoy's character is none too keen on the dancing.
But I'd been forgotten, I've been married a long time ago. Where did you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from, Cotton Eye Joe? But I'd been forgotten, I've been married a long time ago. Where did you come from? Where did you go? Where did you come from, Cotton Eye Joe?
No! Harry!
Hey, Miss, come here.
It's all right, it's all right, it's all right. It's all right, boy. It's all right, you can still do it on your own. 5, 6, 7, 8, come on.
Hey, turn it off, turn it off.
Is there a problem?
Christ, Paddy, he's a child.
What is wrong with you? Why are you talking to him like that?
Ah, now you're parenting our child.
Because we do things differently.
Wow.
This is not about doing things differently. This is about doing what is right, okay? I mean, you should be offering your son some love while he's crying, not shouting at him.
Paddy, he's just a kid. Just let him dance.
That was not dancing. And go to your room, Paddy.
I can't listen to the way you talk.
Go to your room!
Yeah, don't know if I want to go to dinner in their house or on holiday with them. Scoot McNairy and Mackenzie Davis as the seemingly sane couple in that in exchange, Ben and Louise, and then James McAvoy as Paddy and Aisling Franciosi as Kira, his wife. It sounds as if it goes off the rails into a very horror-filled place, Dave.
Yeah, although I would say if I was subjected to Cotton Eye Joe by rednecks, I'd probably have an outburst as well. So it's kind of understandable in that regard. But yes, it's all about the build-up, this is. And it is a curious remake. The film that it's remaking is only 2 years old, has mostly English language in it, and was excellent, by the way. So I was very curious about this one, see how they would handle it. I think for the most part, they get it right. It is about teasing out that awkwardness, and it's putting you, as the viewer, in a situation where you're like, if I was here, what would I do? Would I leave? But you can't leave because of social mores, because of what you're supposed to do, quote unquote. And I should say as well, you only get a taste of it there, but James McAvoy is having an absolute ball in this role. He's amazing in this film.
Yeah. Did you enjoy it as Dave seems to have done to a certain extent, Dee?
I did, yeah. And I found that there were kind of some interesting like themes in this film, like machismo. The theme of parenting is obviously very strong in it. And we see kind of the different types of abuses and really kind of social behaviour. So there's a lot to lot to kind of unwrap in this movie. And I think it's a really strong film from James Watkins, whose credits, director James Watkins, whose credits to date wouldn't be overly impressive, if you ask me, between Eden, like The Woman in Black, and Bastille Day. But you have like James McAvoy kind of reunited with Blumhouse Studio here. They would have worked together on Split. This is a genre he's obviously really strong in.
Stars on this one, Dee?
I give it 3.5 stars. I thought there were great performances, a really kind of concentrated, entrapping ambience, great filmmaking practices, and a compelling story.
Dave?
3.5 as well. Yeah, it shies away from the more extreme nature of the original, as I knew it would. I would actually disagree. I think Eden Lake is an excellent horror film, and there's times when James Watkins gets to tap into that nastiness towards the end. It is a recommend, with the crowd as well.
And stars, did you say?
3.5.
3.5 from you. Finally then, The Critic, starring Ian McKellen as a gay theatre reviewer in the 1930s in London. And we're set in the shadow of fascism, really, here. Gemma Arterton and Leslie Manville and Mark Strong in supporting roles. What is the basic setup here, Dave?
We're dealing with a fearsome critic play by Ian McKellen. He's notorious. At a time when critics could be notorious, he shows up at your play, everyone gets scared, the actors, the director, everybody, because this guy has the power with his words to make or break your production, which is a very, very playful in. And of course, watching this in a room full of critics, we're all seeing our own self-indulgence on the screen. But this goes to many different places, and I think tonally and narratively, it ties itself in knots in a way that doesn't quite work. It is based on a book, Curtain Call, by Anthony Quinn, and it's adapted by Patrick Marber, who's previously responsible for The Excellent Closer, The Excellent Notes on a Scandal. So I was waiting for this kind of acid tongue thing to really kind of take flight and make itself up on the level of the aforementioned.
Yeah.
But I think with each new plot twist and turn, despite the fact that Ian McKellen is absolutely relishing this role, I think it's too confused for its own good.
And if we talk about London and the 1930s, is it making any statements in terms of how that is reflected in where we are today? Did you think that, Dee?
Yeah, I would certainly think that. And I think particularly in Gemma Arterton's character, that's quite interesting. She plays this impressionable actress who almost kind of acts a bit younger than she necessarily is. She's been criticised by Jimmy for years, but they end up kind of developing this rapport because she comes to him after one particularly negative review and is like, "You've been criticising me for years, but you know, I'm actually like a huge fan of a huge fan of yours." And she's so fragile and she's so insecure and easily swayed by men, and you kind of really feel for her because she's aging in this world that is so merciless against aging women. And it kind of got me thinking, has much really changed between now and then when it comes to the way that actresses are treated? But like Dave was saying there, McKellen is absolutely terrific in this movie as well. He is a diva, he's indignant, he's obnoxious, he's sly, and he's repulsive and charming in equal measure. I think I preferred it slightly more than Dave. I quite like the theatrical nature of it, but certainly you do have to suspend your disbelief at times.
Yeah, it goes a little bit into just unbelievable territory.
Yeah, just a bit kind of silly. And I suppose it's reflective that, you know, it was a playwright who wrote the script for it, because it is quite theatre-esque.
All right, stars?
3.5 for me. I did really enjoy it. I mean, it feels like a lot longer than its 95-minute running time because a lot happens in it. But I found it quite enjoyable just seeing such a dastardly brilliant villain.
Stars?
2.5, like I say, it gets in its own way. It has all these interesting ideas but packs too many in. Ian McKellen is the reason to see it. Also, not enough Leslie Manville, which is true of most films.
Yeah, we said that about a film last night, I think, as well. Or was it? Yes, it was last night. Thank you to Dee Malumbi and Dave Hanratty. Lee, Speak No Evil and The Critic all go on general release from tomorrow. The Forest is the Path is the title of the new Snow Patrol album. I think I may have missaid it somewhere along the line. And just to give you those dates again, there will be Snow Patrol in the Ulster Hall in Belfast tomorrow night, February 25th in the A3 Arena in Dublin, two nights at the SSE Arena in Belfast, February 27th and 28th. Snowpatrol.com. And we will review The Forest is the Path tomorrow night here on Arena. That's our lot for this Thursday evening. Paula Shields and Liam Murphy researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Harry Buckless was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. And Ray Cuddihy will be with you after the news.